The following program is made possible with support from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Twameva Mata cha Pita Twameva Twameva Bandhu cha Sakha Twameva Twameva Vidya Dravinam Twameva Twameva Sarvam Mama Deva Deva.
Lily Gauri Sam Sahag Suna. Aide se ekta chala raja Sirkar. Oi Sirkar raja ka ekta beti jan me lelkhin.
In terms of literacy or illiteracy, we've had a very strong oral culture. All communication occurred very orally. The written came much later.
Indians are technically more illiterate than we are. That is, fewer people per 100 know how to read in India. But I would certainly say that literate is a very misleading word. There's certainly much more culture than we are. There are very few Americans, relatively very few Americans, who know the stories of their culture, who know the Bible, who know Shakespeare, who know whatever it is that we decide are good stories. Whereas all Hindus know in great detail all their stories. And of course, it's also well known that people who don't write remember better. And they're great rememberers, the Indians, and they tell, everyone knows those stories. They're very well-educated people culturally, even when they can't read.
Passages to India, a series created by Julian Crandall-Hollick. India's cultures are essentially oral, passed down over hundreds, even thousands of years, from teacher to student, from storyteller to child, and from poet to audience. They've been passed down with such accuracy that nothing has been lost. And they've retained their vitality and fascination because they've constantly been retold and reinvented and adapted for every new generation. Today, thanks to radio, cinema, and the television, this cultural treasure chest is being renewed and transformed yet again. Our program is called Vedas, Ragas and Storytellers.
It's mid-morning and hot on the roof of the Srinandal Bajoria Mahavidya school in Banaras. Three boys are reciting parts of one of the Vedas, those mystical hymns to the gods of nature, that were probably first sung here on the banks of the Ganges 3,000 years ago. If you recited a chapter a day of just the Rig Veda, it would take you almost 2 years. To learn and recite all the Vedas, maybe 12 years. And it goes almost without saying, a true Brahmin Pandit should know them all by heart. These teenagers are learning orally, repeating after the teacher, just like all the previous generations. I'm told these Vedas are perfect copies of the original. It seems quite improbable on the face of it. Not a word, a syllable, a tone, an intonation, nothing altered, even a millimeter or millisecond, or however you measure corruption of a text, over all these thousands of years. The Brahmin Pandits have perfected an incredible way to make sure that what these boys learn by heart is word perfect. The boys are made to rehearse these verses in a way that makes it impossible for them ever to change a syllable or even an accent. Once they've memorized the verse, they have to recite it in different ways until their memory will be perfect and automatic. Verses will be broken down into a succession of words without meaning. In one exercise, the words of a verse, let's say cats and dogs are both animals, are learnt in a strict mathematical progression, like this. Cats and cats, and dogs and cats, and dogs are dogs and, are both animals both are, animals cats and so on. Another technique is to take verses, called shlokas, from different Vedas and then recite them alternately. If you think about it, this is far more effective than the printed word, far more accurate too. Actually, there's another reason why these boys have to learn the Vedas this way. The Vedas are the words of the gods, so they're divine. That gives them magical powers. So it would be death and damnation to anyone who tried to change them or say them differently. But on another level, oral traditions are constantly changing. You see, in India, oral traditions are the backbone of Indian culture. They're its transmission belt, its way of handing down knowledge from generation to generation. And the mere act of passing down a story or a formula or any form of knowledge orally means that the teller constantly revises and adapts the original to his culture, his moods, and his needs. So oral culture turns out to be fantastically creative. It's the technique Indian musicians use to teach their students. Ranganaik Iyengar is a Carnatic or South Indian style musician. Carnatic music differs from Hindustani music in several ways. There's less Muslim influence, and there are substantial differences in the rhythms and the way the rag is allowed to unfold. In her music room at the university in Benares, Iyengar's giving a lesson to a young flute player. She sings a phrase, the flautist then repeats it. Someone once overheard me trying to imitate this when they should have been minding their own business. I was almost certified, and I wasn't talking about the flute.
In Hindustani music, the voice is considered to be the instrument, and all other instruments aspire to vocal expression.
Warren Senders is a young American musician who's come to India to study music.
The quality of sound that's evoked is unbelievable. For people who aren't really familiar with it, it can actually be a little frightening. And it's something that virtually no other instrument can successfully evoke.
Senders came to Pune to study with Bhimsen Joshi, one of the greatest of contemporary Indian classical singers. Bhimsen Joshi ran away from home to become a musician. He wandered for years throughout India looking for the right guru or teacher. Eventually he found him, spent many years learning, and is now nearing the end of his career. He lives in a small house in Pune, practicing and giving lessons and advice to a handful of aspiring musicians. In return, the students help run the household.
In the community we are there, I won't charge anything for them. If somebody wants to learn, I won't charge them. They must learn properly. That's the main thing.
There's no money involved, right?
That's right. There is what is called Guru Dakshina.
Which means?
It is a gift to the guru. It is a, in a sense, you could say it's a symbolic gift. The idea, of course, being that this learning is priceless, and therefore to assign a price to it is really an act of apostasy. And what you do instead is by making a gift of one sort or another, usually a sum of money that is within the student's means and some flowers and sweets, you are demonstrating the fact that you are grateful and that you owe the guru more than you can possibly pay.
In the West, the name of Ravi Shankar is virtually synonymous with the sitar in Indian music. When he's back in Delhi, Ravi Shankar's spacious house is one big extended family of music students.
We have almost, it's like a ritual, you know, we consider our guru as a god or a father figure or something like that, you know, that sort of feeling is there. It's mutual, and the guru feels the same way about the children, and it's like his family. So that give and take cannot be explained because it is so foreign to the Western. It's not just touching the feet, it is not just, but it is the whole feeling itself. It is like a surrender, total surrendership to the guru. And
yes, they have to enter into both your musical but also your spiritual universe.
Exactly. It has to be. It's so much attached to each other, you know, the whole spiritual approach. That's why the period of learning, one has to be maintain certain system, be a little hard on, you know, like things like drugs or drinking or even celibacy and things like that. For a few years, one has to totally channelize the energy to this and nothing else. That is still maintained, but not completely perhaps, but as much as possible, spirit of that is still there.
What the guru is teaching is not just music, but all the culture and history that goes into making a rounded artist.
We have to have both. I mean, it can't be just spiritual, neither can it be just. So it's a beautiful combination because of the oral tradition. Because, you know, the guru doesn't pass just the technique of the music, but along with that, all that goes with the life of the past, how things were there, the connection with the Veda, with the gods and goddesses and stories and parables and so many. So automatically we inherit the spiritual quality along with it.
You mean you sort of tell stories and you'll...
Yeah, absolutely, we have to.
So it's not just practicing...
No.
What else will you do in a day with a
well,
student then?
Well, I mean, we don't...
You're just living together.
We don't sit and tell them stories or something like that. But it comes automatically. This rag represents this. It is connected with such and such god. It was the mythological background, the historical background, the theoretical background. All goes together. So, you know, it's absorbed.
Unlike most Indian classical musicians, Shivkumar Sharma does not come from a musical dynasty. But in the last 35 years, he's made himself and the santoor into one of the most distinctive sounds in Indian music. He lives in a Bombay suburb on the appropriately named Zigzag Road overlooking the Arabian Sea. His music room is also his puja or prayer room. There are effigies of Saraswati and Krishna on the bookshelf. A reminder that you can never really divorce religion from culture in India. Indian classical music, like Vedic recitation, follows a strict and rigid framework handed down from generation to generation.
You see, in our music, there is a basic difference with Western classical. In our music, we have got certain discipline of a rag. You know what a rag is. Rag is not only a scale. Rag depends how are you using the combinations of notes in ascending and descending order. And that has got a particular discipline to be followed.
The rag is therefore the framework, a unique combination of ascending and descending notes.
As I said, scale is not a rag. Now I'll play one scale. Scale straight, and second note is flat,
third is sharp, fourth is sharp, fifth is sharp, and sixth is flat, seventh is sharp. This scale is known as Purvi Thaat. We call it Thaat, the parental scale. Now, in this Thaat, in this scale, we can make different combinations and permutations, combinations of notes, and they can become different ragas. Now, for instance, one rag, this, the name of this rag is Shri. The third note and the sixth note is omitted while ascending. While descending, I'm using all the seven notes. Now, whatever improvisation I'll be doing, I'll have to follow this method, this principle.
Now, Western classical music keeps within the scale and is based on harmony. Indian music takes the same 12 notes and adds quarter and half tones in between each one. And instead of harmony, it's based on a melodic line.
We have the quarter tones because we play melody. And because it is melody, therefore I can do... I can do... Or...
Imrat Khan comes from a long line of musicians. Along with his brother Velayat Khan, he's recognized as one of the greatest sitar players in the world of northern classical music.
So I can slur, I can do... So I can do... So these lines, because they are melodical lines, so they become very, very fine and very sensitive. And you can hear these quarter tones and the expressions, very sensitive expressions, because I'm only playing them onto a melodical line. But if it has to be expressed like this in harmony, it will be completely lost.
Imrat Khan likes to compare Indian classical music to a game of tennis. He says the rigid framework of the rag are the rules of tennis and the lines on the court. But within that framework, players will constantly improvise and play every opponent differently. You can play like a McEnroe or you can play like a Lendl, but you play by the same basic rules.
In Indian classical music, there is a lot of scope for self-expression, and it gives you much more freedom of expressing your own views in the music.
Imrat says that Western musicians are merely interpreters of what a composer has written. They never change the notes. But the oral tradition allows the Indian musician the freedom to take a particular rag and then compose freely according to his mood and his abilities.
So you as a performer are also a composer as well as a performer?
Yes.
I mean, there is no such division as we make in our music between composer and performer. The two functions are combined within the musician.
Yes. A musician of Indian music should be a composer as well.
That doesn't mean it's jazz. There's still a fairly rigid framework.
We have to follow a rag, the entire structure of the rag, which is chosen notes. For instance, if I have chosen, out of the seven note, if I choose... Suppose if I choose on this pentatonic scale, then I will have to stay in these scales. I can't do... These notes I can't play. I will have to play. And in even in sledding. Even in fast movements. So that's where Indian music becomes very strict.
Indian musicians also choose different rags to suit the mood of the different times of the day. Much as we might put Vivaldi's Four Seasons or Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony on when it's crisp and sunny outside, and not at 4 a.m. in the morning. There are 9 of these moods or rasas, each with a fixed emotion, romantic, heroic, erotic, peaceful, each one related to a specific time and season. Shivkumar Sharma says the mood and reactions of the audience obviously determine how a musician will decide to play that day.
And then the basic temperament of a musician. What kind of ragas you like? There are different ragas. Some ragas are very romantic in nature, in mood, in their feelings. Some are very peaceful. Some ragas are very devotional. So you have to be in that mood to bring out the real mood in the rag. So if all those combinations come together, then a musician can improvise at his best. And that is what they say, that a same rag when played or sung at different occasions by the same musician, by the same singer, will sound different.
Shiv Kumar's finally convinced I've understood the basics. Now we're ready for the rag itself.
So now something as little of playing. We call it alap. This is the beginning of a rag. And there are different stages. Then later on, we play with the tabla and compositions and all that. In alap, there are 3 different movements. This, as you heard, the first one, very, very slow. The second is known as jod, in which a beat is formed like this. Then there's the crescendo part, which is known as jhala. So whatever I have played now, I have followed that ascending-descending order system. So this is the system of playing a rag.
If I now asked you to play it again, it wouldn't be the same, right?
The notes will be the same.
But
the mood is different.
The other way Shivkumar can vary within the same rag is by changing the number of beats while the rag's unfolding, from 7 to 10 to 16 beats and back again. It's a wondrous complex thing at the hands of a master. And finally, Shivkumar decides to put it all together in the musical equivalent of an Indian miniature painting called Rag Vasant, the Spring Rag. Music and the Vedas are, of course, not the only traditions passed down religiously from generation to generation. Ayurvedic doctors learn formulas and treatments in exactly the same way. And, of course, there are the stories that form the fabric of Indian culture.
India is and always has been a great storytelling culture. Telling stories is, I think, the basic way, certainly one of the basic ways that Indians have of making sense of the world, of giving information, of making a point, of explaining things to one another and to themselves.
Wendy Doniger is a professor at the University of Chicago, author of numerous erudite volumes on the Vedas and the Puranas. But more importantly, Wendy can spin tales with the best of them.
If you ask a Hindu, why does this happen this way? Why does your family eat this kind of food? Why do you build your buffalo cart this way? They'll say, instead of, as we would say, well, we believe that it has this following effect and we want to have a lot of male children, so we do it, or we believe that this food has this effect upon our bodies, which is an American way of giving the explanation. An Indian way of giving an explanation, an answer to such a question would be, well, you know, the way this food came into the world was once upon a time the god Shiva created this plant and he gave it to someone. And so people tell stories in general as a way of explaining the origins of things and the meanings of things.
Indeed they do. I could tell you many strange and unlikely explanations of everything from a solar eclipse to the hidden treasures guarded by anthills. One morning I was finishing a cup of tea in a garden in the city of Ahmedabad in Gujarat. A pair of squirrels were trying to sneak up and eat the crumbs from breakfast. Now they were normal grey squirrels, but they had four broad black smudges on the fur on their backs. Would they succeed in capturing the crumbs without my noticing? Very interesting tactics. One squirrel tried to divert my attention by staring me right in the eye, while the other snuck round the table to make off with the swag. Now this was an interesting situation, but the waiter hovering nearby had weightier things on his mind, the origin of the species, and his duty to enlighten my ignorance.
I will tell you the story how she had got the straps on her back.
Right.
When Lord Rama, he wanted to construct a bridge, huge monkeys came to help him, because while constructing a bridge, we need very big stones. So then came this little squirrel and asked Lord Rama, oh Lord Rama, may I help you? Then Lord Rama, he just took this squirrel in his left hand and he put his hand on her back and said, oh no, little squirrel, you are too small to carry those stones. Please go away. So when he put the hand on her back, these four fingers became the straps on her back.
And that, dear listener, is how the Indian squirrel got its stripes.
Then there is also a great deal of formal storytelling. You go to any Indian village any time in the afternoon when the heat passes, there's a Brahmin there reading and telling the sacred stories in Sanskrit, in the vernacular, and what it is. People know the Ramayana, they tell the Ramayana, they tell it in Hindi, they tell it in Bengali, they tell it in Tamil. They tell their story. It's one of the great forms of entertainment is telling stories. And the stories have meaning, too. They're charming stories, but they also create a world of narratives about who we are and how we got to be this way, and they're also one of the great sources of fun.
The main characters and the heart of the stories are pretty much common to all India, but the telling itself. Indians become great embroiderers. They take stories from other parts of the country, dress them up to suit their own gods, adapt them to fit their own local legends. The result is creative chaos and great fun. Here's a story from Karnataka about stories and why they should be told, collected and retold here by the poet A.K. Ramanujan.
A housewife knew a story. She also knew a song. But she kept them to herself, never told anyone the story nor sang the song. Imprisoned within her, The story and the song were feeling choked. They wanted release, wanted to run away. One day, when she was sleeping with her mouth open, the story escaped, fell out of her, took the shape of a pair of shoes, and sat outside the house. The song also escaped, took the shape of something like a man's coat, and hung on a peg. The woman's husband came home, looked at the coat and shoes, and asked her, "Who is visiting?" "No one," she said. "But whose coat and shoes are these?" "I don't know," she replied. He wasn't satisfied with her answer. He was suspicious. Their conversation was unpleasant. The unpleasantness led to a quarrel. The husband flew into a rage, picked up his blanket, and went to the monkey god's temple to sleep. The woman didn't understand what was happening. She lay down alone that night. She asked the same question over and over. "Whose coat and shoes are these?" Baffled and unhappy, she put out the lamp and went to sleep. All the lamp flames of the town, once they were put out, used to come to the monkey god's temple and spend the night there gossiping. On this night, all the lamps of all the houses were represented there, all except one, which came late. The others asked the latecomer, "Why are you so late tonight?" "At our house, the couple quarreled late into the night," said the flame. "Why did they quarrel?" "When the husband wasn't home, a pair of shoes came into the veranda and a coat somehow got onto a peg. The husband asked her whose they were. The wife said she didn't know, so they quarreled." "Where did the coat and shoes come from?" "The lady of our house knows a story and a song. She never tells the story and has never sung the song to anyone. The story and the song got suffocated inside, so they got out and have turned into a coat and a pair of shoes. They took revenge. The woman doesn't even know." The husband, lying under his blanket in the temple, heard the lamp's explanation. His suspicions were cleared. When he went home, it was dawn. He asked his wife about her story and her song, but she had forgotten both of them.
You know, Ram, the difference between Ramayana and Mahabharata here and between Odyssey and Iliad is a basic difference.
Radha Prashad Gupta is a writer in Calcutta. He's done something rather wonderful, but unfortunately only on paper. He spent the past few years cataloguing the fast-disappearing sounds of the city.
The Odyssey and Iliad are known to the educated people with classical background. They may not know Latin and Greek, but they can read in translation. You know, they have to go to... But here, every fellow, you know, if you go to a rickshawala, he will tell you about Ramayana.
The Ramayana and the Mahabharata are the two great epics of India. We've got nothing like them. The heroes and heroines are the ultimate role models for every Indian. Their lives a manual of everyday do's and don'ts. Their influence is like some mysterious essence. You find it everywhere. In fact, in much of northern India, people greet each other not with "good morning, it's a beautiful day," but by repeating the name of Ram, the hero of the Ramayana. For the vast majority of Indians, the Ramayana is a religious parable. It sets out different types of behavior and their consequences. Its heroes represent the struggle of good versus evil. Every fall, villages and cities throughout most of northern India give several days over to the retelling of the Ramayana in the festival of Ramlila. In Banaras, the whole city becomes a stage for a 30-day reenactment organized by the Maharaja. In June, the actors are selected. The young boys and girls chosen to play Ram, Sita and other members of their family move to special quarters to study their lines. For many of the audience, they've ceased to be mere actors and have become divine, just like the painted clay effigies that are paraded throughout the streets. When Ramlila begins in early September, all Banaras stops to take part. The whole city becomes the stage and audience, moving every day to a different site where another episode is acted out. It's been years since I watched a live puppet show, and this is probably the last place on earth I ever thought to find one. We had come to spend the night in a village in eastern Gujarat, ostensibly to see how the villagers were learning to cope with a terrible drought. Our host asked us if we wanted to see a traveling puppet show. Well, of course. We waited till dark, then we set out in true Indian fashion, squeezed like sardines, eight to a car, into the black countryside. Miles and miles, stopping at houses to ask if anyone had seen the puppeteers. One farmer said, "They're over at Navin Bai's farm." So off we trundled. But Navin Bai wasn't at home. His wife came out, peered suspiciously into the back of the car, saw three pink-skinned foreigners, and sent us on to another village. "Try the milk co-op. I heard they were playing there tonight." Finally, one farmer said they were at Kirti Shah's farm. "How far is that?" "Oh, no more than a mile. Just follow the track." In India, one grows suspicious of statements like that. For the next 60 minutes, we ground our way forward and sideways, in first or second gear, down embankments, across riverbeds, between banyan trees, along hedgerows, through fields of winter wheat. The car wheezed and coughed, keeled to starboard, then to port, struggled up, then down. Horrible sounds from its depths, metal straining against the laws of gravity, gears grinding. But the standard Indian car is a wondrous creation, like the buffalo, slow, ugly, but with great stamina. And then suddenly we were there, in a big field where a couple of hundred villagers had gathered on benches to watch the puppets. All eyes on the scaffolding where the puppeteers are preparing their charges. They work in the fields by day and take this show across the fields by night. Much fidgeting among the young children, all waiting for the treat to begin. Little fanfare on the PA system. And they're off. A handsome prince, a seedy villain, and a monkey that seems possessed of divine foresight. Great laughter and applause. It's our old friend the Ramayana again, this time reduced to 90 minutes with intermission. You see, the epics are really a mixture of classical folk and popular culture, retold all over India. They interact with each other. They get tangled up with regional and folk tales into an extraordinary jungle of complexity and variety. A.K. Ramanujan once told me there were 18 different types of retelling the epics in Karnataka alone. You don't have to go very far to find pure folk culture. 200 miles to the northwest, the Langas and Manganyas have developed a musical tradition that owes little, if anything, to the classical music traditions of the upper castes or the Mughals. We met up one night with a group of musicians in an old warehouse on the outskirts of the desert city of Jodhpur. For two nights, they sang and played for us till dawn, then attacked a huge dinner and proceeded to sleep the day off until dusk. Jodhpur was periodically plunged into total darkness. Indians call this euphemistically load shedding. The car battery was too weak, so a current was jury-rigged from an emergency generator next door. Rajputs are magnificent fighting men, tall, fierce, weather-beaten faces, swathed in turbans that seem to sweep up to the stars. Their songs match their pride. Yeah.
All these musicians are hereditary professional caste musicians. Whole of their music training actually comes to them as a matter of tradition, father and son. Or if father is not an excellent musician, in that case, he has to learn it from some other relation.
Kumal Kattar has been working with folk musicians near Jodhpur for many years. In some families, these musical traditions go back over 400 years. As caste musicians, the Langas and Manganyas enjoy an unusual status.
They are appearing to certain homes who are known as their patron castes. One particular musician might be serving, 200 or 300 families by music.
Is this sort of a guarantee of employment?
As a patron, I am obliged to pay every time when the occasions arrive, like childbirth, marriage, festivities, and like that, They would arrive and you will have to entertain them and give them gifts, money, cash.
Ah, but what happens if the patrons don't pay them?
In that case, they would, first bury their turban. After, they will make an effigy, very insulting, obscene effigy of the patron, tie it to the donkey's tail, take it round the number of his family members and like that. And in that case, that patron family will be outcasted from its own group. And then there will be huge difficulty of getting their children married. Their all family relations will not be able to invite them for food or join in anything. So they have a huge power that way.
There are other caste musicians in India. One of the better known are the Alis or eunuchs. The cattle market in the southern temple city of Madurai is a dusty place. Most days it seems deserted. Maybe it's not the right season to trade cattle. Today, Mani and his eunuch band have come to play for us. Mani himself is a youthful 65. Like his fellow eunuchs, he's dressed as a woman with makeup and lipstick. Mani's mischievous. He asks the engineer for a date.
We have this talent of singing and dancing, so we form as a group, and wherever there is a wedding or a death ceremony or a naming ceremony, the people would come to us and invite us to sing for that occasion, to take part in the occasion. So on the invitation, we go to their places and we do what we are asked to do, and we are paid for it. This is how I earn this skirt and money and a lot of other things, and they feed us also.
But why do they ask you as a particular group to come and perform these things?
The people think that we are not like the other people who have indulged in their family lives and going astray, doing all kinds of sinful things. But we are not married, we are not have any such things. And people also consider us, we have some extraordinary power. So people come to us and ask us to participate in their social functions.
The songs that you sing, have these been handed down from generation to generation, or are they simply folk songs from Tamil Nadu that you've picked up?
நான் நாலு பேர்த்த போல பல கஷ்டமெல்லாம் பட்டு இந்த ஆட்டத்துக்கு வந்தேன். ஆட்டத்துக்கு வந்து பல கொஞ்சம் நாள் கஷ்டப்பட்டேன். பிற்பாடு நாலு தெருவு ஜனங்களை பழக போய் எனக்கு எந்த விதமான குறைபாடு இல்லாமல்
There are men in town who wrote such folk songs in Madurai, and they are expert in folk music. So I went to all those people. I worked for them. I even washed their loincloth sometimes, because he's my guru, so I have to do whatever the guru wants me to do. So these are the things I did for him. I learned so many songs and dance and everything. Then I started I started teaching to my friends. This is how I learned all this skill, talent.
Selam sasa, selam tumare pai. Borona er mazi mure banai.
Bengal is Delta country. Life is spent on the water, fishing, sailing, hauling the boat upstream along the river bank. The boatmen, or Batialis, used to sing their own brand of folk songs as they rowed and sailed down the Ganga and the Brahmaputra to the Bay of Bengal. In this song, Himanga Biswas thanks his uncle for helping him get a good job on the river. "I'm quite well off now," he says, "because I'm pilot of a boat." It's becoming rare to find authentic Batiali singing. It's also much harder to find street bhajan singers like Ram Krishna singing for their supper. Bhajans are popular religious hymns, usually about Ram and Sita, or Krishna and Radha. This is the sort of place you'd expect to find them, in the high-rise luxury apartments on Bombay's exclusive Malabar Hill. Ram Krishna's been earning a living singing bhajans here for the past 15 years. He reckons on getting 20 to 40 rupees a day, or $10 a week. Usually, bhajans are sung in chorus. This group are about to go on a pilgrimage to the hills that separate Tamil Nadu from Kerala. There's a third type of music. That's the popular music associated with Indian cinema. It's the music you hear blaring from street corners. Now you might think this song was all about lost love, or gazing into your beautiful brown eyes, finding paradise in your embrace, and so on and so on. You're probably right about paradise, but it's paradise with Lord Krishna, not Sushil Bhattachary. No moon in June lyrics, and no distinction between the spiritual and the secular. Same theme, different treatments. Here are three songs to Krishna. The first is classical khayal sung by Lakshmi Shankar. The second is a folk bhajan sung by Yashoda Devi, a poor widow in Bihar. The third is a pop song sung by Anoop Jalota, a popular film playback singer.
दीवानी राधा को तू माखन से ना तो प्रेम दीवानी राधा को तू माखन से ना तो ओ राधा.
The big question is, what effect will the media have on oral culture? In a country where only 35% of the population is literate, oral culture is obviously of tremendous importance and relevance.
What we have is two distinct cultures, the oral culture in the villages, among the illiterates. And with literacy, the oral culture has gone in the urban areas, had gone.
The Bengali poet and writer Nabanita Dev Sen.
And now it's coming back with the radio, with the television. And it's a different kind of oral culture. It's not the same thing. It's more audiovisual. And the poetry readings, etc., that take place now in theatres, I must confess it is not the same as the poetry readings, epic readings that take place under a banyan tree in a village.
Does that mean that the old oral tradition will die out because of the media spreading gradually into the villages?
I am afraid it will. It is. Now there is an effort to bring it back into life, and there are folk institutes who are trying to retrieve the folk culture, who are trying to get hold of these singers, the bards, mm-hmm. and trying to preserve their art, trying to tape as much as possible, because it is dying out very fast.
Yes, it's ironic that eradicating illiteracy can also undermine the vitality of the oral traditions. Maybe I'm too pessimistic. Maybe the oral traditions will be able to change and adapt yet again. The big question is, what will television and the VCR do to these oral traditions? The first offerings are not very promising. The wonders and mysteries of the Ramayana and the Mahabharata have now been reduced to Sunday morning soap operas, which the whole nation, it seems, watches lost in helpless admiration.
बाजे कान के पास बजाओ सीताराम चरित अति
Vedas, Ragas and Storytellers was written and produced by Julian Crandall-Hollick and Dean Capello. The recording assistants in India were Rana Behel, Raja Chatterjee and Raj Shekharan. The theme music was composed and performed by Shubha Shankaran. Consultants for this program were A.K. Ramanujan of the University of Chicago, Brian Silver of International Music Associates and Keshav Kothari of the Sangeet Natak Academy. For more information about cassette copies of this series, please phone 1-800-854-TAPE during regular business hours. Passages to India is a production of IBA, Independent Broadcasting Associates, and is made possible with major grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities and the Rockefeller Foundation. Support for the national distribution of this program is provided by this and other national public radio member stations and by the NPR Cultural Program Fund. Contributors include the National Endowment for the Arts, and Bramalee Pacific, master developer of Oakland, California's city center office development. I'm Deepika Roy.
Jatna uchha